You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Polling shows that people believe crime is on the rise in the United States, but our guest says that's actually not true over the years and hasn't been for quite a while. We'll dive into the data coming up. First, Milwaukee may not be the biggest city in the Midwest, but its rock and roll scene has been putting its unique stamp on music since the 1950s. Now, a book is highlighting some of the musicians, venues, and DJs who made the city's music what it is. The editors of that book joined us in February. The book is called Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 to 2000, A Reflective History. David Lurson is the managing editor of the Shepherd Express. He's written several books on history and punk rock. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Bruce Cole is librarian at Marquette University and curator of the school's Milwaukee Music Collection. He's been a drummer for more than 50 years. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And then Philip Naylor is a professor of history at Marquette. He introduced a course on rock and roll history there. Phil, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, Bruce, I want to start with you. You've got a unique perspective on rock and roll bands in Milwaukee history because reading the book, it seems like you were in just about all of them. Can you take us to the early days as a teenager? There's this new thing going on, rock and roll, and you wanted to be part of it.
Yeah, I was. I was part of it.
Yeah. Well, talk about your first experience in a rock and roll band in Milwaukee.
Okay, it's my first experience with a rock and roll band, I think, was in 1963, and my sister's boyfriend actually had a friend who had a band, and it was just a little band with an accordion and a guitar, and their drummer had quit, and they needed a fill-in drummer. And I had two drums and some sticks, and so I filled in, and it was a lot of fun. But my first real band was in 1964, and I met some very important local players, and they helped me get into a band called the Grand Prix, and that was my first sort of real rock band.
Dave, some cities have an identity or a sensibility that at least people claim runs through their music. There's been a lot of styles in Milwaukee that you guys write about in the book, but is there something that unites it all in your mind, Dave?
Well, I don't know about the style so much because there are so many different genres covered by Milwaukee rock musicians over the decades. Strong songwriting has been really prevalent here since at least the early 1970s. I would put some of the great songwriters of Milwaukee up against their counterparts in much bigger cities. But then there's this whole blue-collar ethic, which again is not maybe unique to Milwaukee. Maybe Cleveland was the same way. Maybe parts of Chicago were the same way. But this was a really hardworking town, and even if you were a kid rebelling against the older generation at that point, somehow you imbued this attitude. Maybe I'm not going to work in a factory like my father did, but I'm going to work really hard as a rock musician, and this is hard work. I mean, it's not just lounging around having fun all day. I mean, to make this work, gigging in clubs in an area like Milwaukee or through the Midwest, it's a lot of work and a lot of hard effort.
And Dave just mentioned the clubs, the venues, and Phil, they're characters of their own in the book. What were some of the places that mattered in this history of Milwaukee rock music?
Well, you have Shank Hall today, but it used to be called Teddy's, which did a lot of blues in particular. You had Century Hall, which burned down, was another important site. Zach's North Avenue was a particular favorite, particularly because Zach brought in blues, and also it was a punk headquarters. What was so great about all these sites is that you could get to meet and talk with the performers. What distinguishes Milwaukee rock, at least to me, is its accessibility to audiences, and also you just have just the talent itself was very, very impressive. So I'd have to say that those were just some of the clubs, and there were so many others. The Avant Garde, the Scene, major place downtown, which brought in great acts from all over the country, and for that matter, international acts. And the Cream, for example, played at the Scene.
talking to the editors of the book Milwaukee Rock and Roll 1950 to 2000. Bruce Cole, David Lurison, and Philip Naylor are with us. Now we've got a little taste of some of the music. You cover so many acts in the book. Let's give a listen to Sam McHugh. Bruce, I think you called him the fountainhead of rock and roll in Milwaukee. Here's a listen to his group, The Legends, and the song Say Mama from 1963. Bruce, can you talk about Sam McHugh's piece of the Milwaukee music history scene?
Yeah, I met Sam when I was about, actually around 12 or 13. The guy across the street, I grew up on 103rd and Greenfield, off of Greenfield, and he drove their truck around, and I got to drive around with him, and got to be good friends. They were really nice guys. Sam was a regular guy, and his drummer, Jim Cecity, actually got me into this first band. We were out where they play at Muskego Beach, and then I didn't have a band, and I was too young. And he told a friend of his that I was the best drummer in West Dallas. And so the guy hired me, and it worked out. And from then on, I kind of had my ticket punch, so to speak, because we played out at Muskego Beach about 10 times, and that was kind of the place to be. If you played out there, then everybody thought you were a big deal.
And Bruce, you write that in Milwaukee, you can divide rock up into before, during, and after the Beatles in this era. What was happening in Milwaukee in this, you know, as the Beatles hit? Did you see a lot of bands try to create that British invasion sound?
Yeah, I think it was the Beatles, and it was what was attracted to the Beatles, which was all these young girls, 10, 11, 12-year-old girls, who for the first time had money in their pocket and would go out and buy 45 RPM records, and that's what, you know, that's what sort of made the Beatles and the British Invasion as popular as it was. And then having all these young guys, 15, 14, 16, 20, baby boom guys, and they all wanted to jump on that train, and so all of a sudden you had these 135 bands around Milwaukee all doing Beatles songs and growing long hair and trying to look like their favorite Beatle.
And Phil, in this era too, a folk music scene, a folk rock around the country, what did we see in Milwaukee with that influence?
Well, you certainly have one person in particular who was the impresario of all of this, and that was Nicholas Topping. Nick Topping, remarkable individual who began acting as a kind of an impresario, organizing folk concerts, bringing in people like Pete Seeger, bringing in international artists, Mikis Theodorakis, the great Greek composer. He brought him in. He brought in Bob Dylan. That didn't work out too well because Dylan was not satisfied with the sound system. But just a wonderful individual. And that, again, you know, characterizes Milwaukee. You have these wonderful people, kind of a confluence of not only musical talents, but of people who were interested in sharing what they knew about music with an audience. I see so many of these musicians and owners of clubs, for that matter, as being educators. Certainly FM radio playing an important role here, too, and just educating people about different kinds of music, different styles, genres, and all of that. And, you know, the folk scene was part of that. But, you know, to have Gene Ritchie here, to have Josh White, go on and on with some of the great names.
You mentioned radio. Part of the book is devoted to the city's radio personalities. I want to get a taste of one of them, Dr. Bop, an R&B DJ on WAWA out of Elm Grove.
I think it really should have been triplets. It's unfair for one man to be so tough. Bop be my name, music is my game, and WAWA is my claim to fame. And I'm that cat with a fine brown frame.
Dave, can you talk about the role of radio in the history of Milwaukee rock?
Well, we were very lucky during the 1970s when I was in high school to have two good FM rock stations, somewhat free form, WZMF and WQFM. and several notable DJs working in those areas came to work at those stations. Bob Reitman, of course, being the one we remember most. He's still on the air in Milwaukee, elsewhere. And, of course, they played largely, you know, national releases, but there was room in the programming at that time for some local releases. And there were albums being released by people in the 1970s here in Milwaukee, Sigmund Snopek, Jim Spencer, and other people. And they were getting a taste of airplay here. Gary Tannen, another example of that. So it was a flourishing environment. Also, we had an underground newspaper called the Bugle American that covered some of the local people. And I grew up thinking that Milwaukee was a place where things were happening and could happen, where creative people could find a platform or a microphone to sing through. And you didn't necessarily have to move out to New York or Los Angeles to make music or do something important. If you didn't want to, you could do it here.
We're listening back to a conversation from earlier this year with Dave Lurson, Bruce Cole, and Phil Naylor, editors of the book Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 through 2000, A Reflective History. We want to hear from you. What bands or musicians from the Milwaukee area do you remember? Anyone you think should have gotten more credit and attention? Do you have memories of the rock music scene in Milwaukee or whatever your part of the state might be? Did you play with any of these bands? Are you still playing music there? Tweet us at Central Time, WPR, and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to our conversation from early this year with Bruce Cole, Phil Naylor, and Dave Lurson. They're the editors of the book Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 to 2000, A Reflective History. What about you? What Milwaukee music memories do you have? Are there local rock bands or venues, past or present, that you were a fan of? Did you play with any of them yourself? And wherever you are, what do you think gives the city a healthy music scene? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll go to your calls now. Larry is with us in Marcusson. Larry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, when I was a teenager, 14, 15, 16, we used to see a lot of free concerts down in Grant Park in South Milwaukee. It was just awesome. Do you recall that at all?
Any of our guests want to jump in on Grant Park live music? Any memories there?
Well, the alternate site on the northern shore of the lake was a big deal in the 1970s. Grant Park, I don't know about that. Anybody here know about Grant Park?
No takers, no, all right?
I think I played in Grant Park, but I can't remember.
Uh-oh. It must have been a heck of a show. Larry, thanks a lot for that call. I want to get into the Milwaukee punk scene a little bit here. Dave, one of the bands you wrote about, we'll give a listen here, the Haskells from 1980, Taking the City by Storm. Dave, we talked about radio and the rock bands. Punk rock maybe had a tougher time getting on the air. How did they get the word out?
Word of mouth and posters and flyers. I got introduced to the Haskells. I was 17 years old, still in high school, writing for a very short-lived underground newspaper here in town, and went to their house on the east side and just sort of, you know, fell into the scene. I mean, they seemed like authentic, creative people with a little bit of a different take on music and where music might be going. I mean, the enormous wealth of songwriting within that band, with two very distinct songwriters, Jerome Bridge and Richard Lavallier, working different ends of the spectrum. So, yeah, radio was not helpful at that moment. In a couple of years, though, college radio station, which became WMSE, became important in promoting newer forms of music of all kinds internationally, but also they kept a close ear to the ground here in Milwaukee.
We heard from Luann in Germantown, who says that there's a place, the Attic in downtown Milwaukee. Yes. Sorry, I've got to look at my screen here. They had some good gigs. She saw the Everly Brothers there, and people got to meet them backstage. There's that access, Phil. Milwaukee, maybe the distance between the stars and the fans wasn't as big as it might have been elsewhere.
And, you know, speaking about the Everly Brothers, again, you have that Milwaukee connection because Sam McHugh toured with them. He was their guitarist. And
20 years.
That was how many years? 20 years, Bruce said. So, yeah, you had that access. Muddy Waters was at Zach's North Avenue for about five nights or so. And this is just unbelievable to have, you know, to have this great blues man here for that long of a time. And you could after a set, he'd come and talk. You could talk with them. You could just basically become acquainted. And I described this to a friend of mine as being, you know, for me being about the same as, you know, meeting an important statesman of Europe. And the guy was just so famous and so important, and to have him so accessible. And again, you have this great confluence of great musicians in so many different genres. And the three of us believe basically that that had to be, you know, certainly recognized. And it was recognized by a lot of people, but in some ways it had to be archived. So that's what we did.
Let's bring on another caller now. Carol is with us in Oak Creek. Carol, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, you have a chapter on Milwaukee women rock musicians. I know back in the day there was like the GTOs and Ruby Star, and I was just wondering if you covered other women musicians.
Well, before we get an answer, by coincidence, we have a clip from Ruby Star referenced in the chapter that does exist in the book. Here's Ruby Star with the band Grey Ghost and a song Burnin' Whiskey from 1975.
Seems you had it with all of my games. Trouble in hard times come with my name.
I know another author had written the Women in Music chapter. Just wondering, you want to talk about women in the Milwaukee rock scene a little bit?
Well, yeah, the person who did that chapter, Rose Trupiano, has been a great advocate of women and rock, and we're really happy to have her included in the book itself. But it was important to have women in it because rock has this image occasionally of being very patriarchal, and we wanted to address that. And we discovered, at least, Rose knew about this, and she shared this information with us about some really, great people. Sue DeBacco from Chicago, for example, who's in the chapter, got to talk with her a few times, and just a tremendous blues rocker. And again, these were people who needed to be recognized, and we tried to do that.
Thanks for that call. We'll bring on Kitty now in Glendale. Kitty, hello.
Okay, I used to go to Muskego Beach in the day and heard them out there, and the song by the Legends, I used to hear them out at the old house. So I'm enjoying the show, and keep it going.
Kitty, thanks a lot for the call. You know, it seems like, do you guys run into people where you tell them you're working on this rock and roll book and they have their memory of the show or the place or the scene that they used to be part of?
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, that happens a lot. When this young lady mentioned the old house, mm-hmm. there was it used to be out on what they call the Ozaukee Beer Run when northern Wisconsin outside of Milwaukee was an 18-year-old world of
teen bars,
and that was with Weiler's, the old house. Those were really, really wild places. You know, it was just sort of because 18-year-old meant also that you'd have 16-year-olds in there with fake IDs and. Unfortunately, there were a lot of accidents coming in and out of those bars on the way back and forth from Milwaukee.
So that was, I think there was a stretch in the book you mentioned, drinking age in Milwaukee was 21 for spirits. It was 18 out of town?
Yes. All over, as soon as it became 18 all around northern Wisconsin, just outside, all of a sudden there were every roadhouse in Wisconsin outside of up north became a teen bar, and you could play these places six nights a week, And that was a lot of work because I remember spending a summer going, when I was 16, playing teen bars from Eau Claire to Superior to Green Bay to Appleton, Nenana, Manitowoc, all over the place, 5-6 nights a week. And I was, I think I was 16 at the time, and I came back and bought a brand new car. I was the only kid in high school with a brand new car.
Now, I know your book goes up to 2000, but I really want to get to hear from each of you if there's a local or area act that you're following nowadays or maybe playing in nowadays. Let's start with you, Bruce.
Well, the act I'm following is the act I play with now called the Doo-Wop Daddies, and it's probably the most fun band I've ever been in. It's seven people, and they do doo-wop. They do music from the 50s and very early 60s, and the vocals are just absolutely terrific, and it's a show.
Phil, how about you?
Well, I actually continue to explore some of the talent that has traditionally been here, like Paul Sebar and Sigmund Snopek. People like that continually interest me, and in part because of their explorations.
And Dave, your modern-day Milwaukee favorites.
I don't want to single any one or two groups out, but I'm pleasantly surprised in recent years of an upsurge of some of what we've been talking about here. Quality songwriting, high energy, reinventing the essence of rock and roll for a new era. It's still happening here in Milwaukee.
And Dave, I want to give you the last word. The title is A Reflective History, not The History of Milwaukee Music. You cover a lot, but there's more. Other people have different perspectives. That was kind of an important point to you. This is not the definitive thing.
Well, I'm against any author who writes the history of Great Britain or the history of the United States or whatever it may be, because there are many histories. And we made the honest attempt in the book to try to represent a number of voices and perspectives. There's room for a second revised, expanded edition.
We'll look forward to that. Thank you all so much for joining us today. It's been a lot
Thank
of fun.
You. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That was David Lurson, Bruce Cole, and Philip Naylor. They're editors of the book Milwaukee Rock and Roll, 1950 to 2000, A Reflective History. We talked with them back in February. We'll go to the news with one more Milwaukee band, The Shivers, with Please Stand By. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to a Milwaukee election official to find out how the state's biggest city is getting ready for next week's voting. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a number of cities have seen an increase in homicides this year as compared to last year, including Milwaukee. And Madison has been in the news for an increase in shots fired incidents, including this week when Madison police say dozens of shots were fired near a crowd of people at a city park earlier this week. Add in the riots that happened in the wake of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis on Memorial Day, and it might seem like crime is at a historically high level. But our next guest says that's actually not the case in the long run. In fact, she says crime has been on the decline for decades now, and that polling shows that we tend to overestimate our risk of being victims of crime. Maggie Kurth is a Minneapolis-based senior science writer for 538. She recently co-wrote a piece on America's crime rate and public perception. Maggie, good to have you back with us on Central Time.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, can you talk about the long-term crime trends? I know some violent crime has been up this year, but when we look in the long haul, what have we seen over the last few decades?
Well, basically, since the mid-90s, crime has been on the decline. You know, there's been a couple of little blips. You saw one around 2010, 2011-ish. But for the most part, it's significantly down and it continues to trend downwards. And that's really just what we've seen year over year. That's true for violent crime. It's incredibly true for property crime. And at the same time, though, our belief that crime has increased, has stayed about the same, and really since the 2000s has gone up, even though crime has not.
And you shared some polling. This is a bit older, but interesting surveys over a period where people were asked, hey, what is your risk of blank bad thing happening to you? And we, if I'm reading you right, we really overestimated our risk of being victims of crime.
Right. So these researchers, they did surveys with people, kind of talking to them about things like burglary, job loss, losing health insurance. And this was in a survey that happened over 10 years, so from 1994 to 2004. And each year they were asking two different questions. You know, how likely are you to have this bad thing happen to you in the next year? And did this bad thing happen to you last year? So they were able to sort of compare like the percentages of people who thought it was going to happen to them in, you know, 1996 versus how many people actually had that happen in 1996. And what they found was that, you know, people put their chance of being robbed in the coming year on average as 15%. But looking back, the actual rate of robbery was 1.2%. And if you looked at things like job loss, we were much better at estimating our risk of something like job loss, where people were guessing about 14.5% and the actual rate was closer to 12.9%. So we're worse at estimating our risk of crime than we are at estimating our risk of other bad things.
So it's interesting to think about what causes that. And you and your co-author are careful to make the point, and I'm paraphrasing here, these aren't your words, but to make the point that this isn't happening because we're all idiots. What is driving the mismatch between our perception and the reality of crime?
Well, because there's a lot of things that feed into perception of crime, right? And one of the things that I thought was really interesting here was there's a researcher called Wesley Scogan who's been doing all these studies where he goes to community meetings in Chicago and listens to like what people in different neighborhoods all over the city talk up to police about being problems in their neighborhood. And one of the things that he has found over time is that the things that people are most concerned about aren't necessarily like the biggest deal things. You know, like people are concerned about murder, but that's not the kind of stuff that they're bringing up constantly with the police. What they're bringing up constantly to the police are, you know, things like loitering, things like public drunkenness, things like litter on the streets. You know, they wanted the police to do things about that more than they were concerned even about something like gang violence. So one of the things that sort of comes up in this research is that people perceive threat and people perceive danger from things that are low-level crimes that we don't necessarily track very well on a national level. And they perceive threat from things that aren't technically crimes at all. So if you have a neighborhood that has a great deal of litter, that has loud music playing, you know, that has some abandoned properties, you're probably going to feel like crime is higher than it actually is, even, you know, irregardless of how much crime there actually is happening in that neighborhood.
So if I say in a survey, yeah, I'm worried about crime, that might be a stand-in for I'm worried about, and you use the phrase social disorder. That might be what's driving that survey answer.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting because there used to be this theory that, you know, broken windows theory, the idea that like if we go in and clean up a neighborhood, that will reduce crime. And what a lot of this research is pointing to, you know, researchers have found out over the years that that really doesn't work, that that theory is wrong. But what this research is pointing to is the idea that like, well, maybe what broken windows theory actually points to is that if you clean up a neighborhood, people feel safer, whether they are or not.
We're talking to Maggie Kurth from 538. She co-wrote a piece on America's crime rate and public perceptions of crime. And now, Maggie, we've got a year like 2020 where we see the homicide rate definitely in many communities going up as compared to 2019. You're not ignoring that reality. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, no, I mean, the homicide rate is definitely up this year. And there are probably lots of reasons why that is, and we won't entirely know what those are for a long time, if ever. I mean, one of the things that got us interested in this topic is that we've never quite figured out why crime rose precipitously in the 70s, late 60s to mid 80s, and why it dropped off in the 90s. Like, no one really knows the answers to those questions. There are lots of theories, but nobody's ever figured it out. And we actually did this story as a preliminary into capturing that bigger story. So I think one of the things to keep in mind is that everybody's going to have a theory about why murder is up this year, but nobody actually knows the answer. And we're unlikely to have one single answer explain it all.
That's homicides. What do we know about the other crimes that are measured by local, state, and ultimately federal authorities? What's happening with crime outside of homicides?
Well, it varies a lot by city to city, obviously, but overall, other crimes besides homicides are still down this year. So property crimes are down this year. It is an interesting thing, and I don't have a good explanation for why that is, but it seems like you have a lot of different things that could be feeding into, you know, simmering resentments and tensions, and that is causing this weird disconnect where you have homicide going up but other crimes going down.
At one point you make in your piece at 538 is that crime rate sounds like a really simple statistic. A lot goes into it. Can you talk about what we're saying when we talk about crime rates that ultimately get reported at the federal level?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different ways that we track crime rates, but ultimately they're only tracking certain kinds of crimes. So when you talk about the crime rate, you aren't talking about drug-related crimes. That's one of the big things that gets left out. And it's one of the big things that can lead to people maybe feeling like their neighborhood is less safe when the crime rate, less safer than the crime rate says it is, right? Because if you're having people getting picked up for drug use, if you're having people getting picked up for, you know, low-level dealing, that's not getting captured in what the crime rate is. So, you know, that's one of those things that gets left out of there. There's also the fact that, like, some crimes are notoriously underreported. Sexual assault is something that we know from victim surveys happens a lot more often than it gets reported. But researchers say that because you can look at things and these trends, you see these trends with things like homicide going down over time, things that we are pretty sure we're capturing all of in the data, that we know that those downward trends are for real. It's just we don't necessarily see all of the different crimes when we're talking about what the crime rate is.
We're talking about crime in the United States and why many Americans think it's getting worse over the years when statistics show it's actually been on the decline for decades. Maggie Kurth is with us, senior science writer for 538, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to hearing that crime overall has been on the decline in the United States for many years now? Does that surprise you or not? How worried are you about being a victim of crime? Do you feel more or less safe where you live compared to a few years ago? Even if crime is going down, do you think it's still a major issue, something to worry about in the U.S.? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about crime in America. Polling shows that most Americans overestimate the risk of being victims of crime and believe that crime has gone up over time, while crime numbers have generally trended down over the last couple few decades. Maggie Kurth is with us, senior science writer for 538, who recently co-wrote a piece about crime and perception. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that, your thoughts, what you see in your own community, what you worry about. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Quickly, I was going to ask your guest if she felt that the media accurately portrays crime within the United States and gives an accurate assessment of the rates of crime. And does she think that the defunding of the police movement that's going on now, would that adversely affect the decrease in crime that we're seeing right now?
Charlie, thanks. Two big questions there. First of all, how media represents crime, Maggie?
Well, that's actually one of the big things that researchers have sort of found influences outsized fears of crime that don't match actual rates. We know from research that people who watch more local TV news think that the crime rate is higher than it actually is compared to people who don't. And we've also found that TV news disproportionately portrays white people as victims of crimes and black people as perpetrators, and that that feeds into some of these other things we see where people view a neighborhood as more dangerous because young black men live there, irrespective of the actual crime rate of that neighborhood. So there are definitely like some factors where the media is really distorting the picture on this, and it kind of comes back to that whole "if it bleeds, it leads" thing. You know, as one of our sources told us, nobody's going to hop on your TV news and tell you that it was a nice, peaceful night in Austin, Texas tonight. They're looking for things that are scary and dangerous and out of the ordinary, and that's what people see. As for the defunding the police, I don't know that there is any research that can tell you one way or another what that has to do with the crime rates that are happening this year. This is something that has not really happened before. And there's a lot of things that are happening that have not really happened before. You know, you have people being cooped up with COVID. You have a whole bunch of different political tensions simmering over. You have the George Floyd protests. You have all these other different things. I'm not sure that there's a good way of saying what impact calls to heavily reform, defund, change the way policing is done in the U.S., what role that that has yet.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Ray now in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
I think it's quite obvious the murder rate in Milwaukee is double what it was last year. The shootings, Milwaukee, Chicago, New York, you name the big cities, something very ugly is going on. And if you've taken a drive down Capitol Drive on a Sunday morning, I will not see any police patrols from the east side all the way to 78th Street and Capitol. But when I return home to the east side, there's a police patrol near my house at least every 20 minutes. So there is definitely something going on. And I feel terrified with the reckless driving in Milwaukee. It's out of control.
Ray, thanks for the call. Ray pointing, I think, toward policing, he says, being concentrated where it is not needed. Under-policing where police might be needed, he says, and over-policing where it isn't so much. Do you have thoughts on that, Maggie?
Well, one of the really interesting things I have found in this research that we've been doing on crime and policing is that crime is a hyper-local thing. Like, it's not even a neighborhood basis. It's more like a block type of thing. Like, I think they were saying that one of the researchers I was talking to was saying that like 80% of the homicides in Chicago happen on like the same five census tracts. I mean, it's very, very hyper concentrated. And one of the things that, you know, people who study how to do effective policing have been doing over the years is trying to get some of these different departments to pay attention to things like that, to the idea that it's not a neighborhood thing, it's an individual house thing, it's a block thing, and that just being present and being a part of that community can make a difference in ways that over-policing some neighborhoods and under-policing others don't.
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. Just a couple minutes left, Maggie. As you said, this is kind of an entry point into a wider discussion of what makes crime go up and what makes it go down. What kind of things are you looking to figure out and to figure out how to figure out in the months to come?
Oh man, this is such an interesting question. And it is something that we got interested in because we'd seen all of these different stories where somebody would come out and be like, okay, we know why the crime decline happened. It was because we got rid of leaded gasoline, or we know why the crime decline happened. It's because abortion was legalized, or we know why the crime decline happened. It's this other thing. And the truth is, when you actually start looking into the data, like none of those things hold up, or at least they don't hold up as the only thing, as like a large portion of what's going on here. And it's actually something that we've seen in a lot of other countries as well. You know, it's not just the U.S. Crime went up in almost every Western country in the same time period, and it went down in almost every Western country in the same time period. Obviously at different levels, because the U.S. has more crime than every other country. But it is interesting that that pattern Southern is everywhere, and we don't know why. So I think a lot of our future reporting is sort of going to be around why don't we have answers to this thing that I think a lot of people look at and assume there must be an obvious answer to.
Maggie, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll watch for that future reporting.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Maggie Kurth. She's a senior science writer over at 538. We talked to her about America's declining crime rate over time, despite some upticks in particular kinds of crime, especially homicide this year, and also why perceptions of crime in the public don't always match up with the reality. When University of Wisconsin campuses across the state start reopening later this month, there will be masks, social distancing, and smartphone apps aimed at limiting new outbreaks. As Rich Kramer reports, the success of all those preparations could depend on what students and employees do off campus.
At the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, a small group of student employees are working their way through every classroom and meeting space, removing thousands of chairs while also setting up hundreds of hand sanitizing kiosks.
So we need to set those up, and there's about 275 of them up in surplus that we have to put together.
The goal is at least 6 feet of space between every person, which can only be accomplished by keeping about half of students in any given class out of the room and learning online. Nursing major Eleanor Slotek is part of the crew prepping campus for the return of around 11,000 students. She feels good about the university's plans, but is less sure about what happens when class lets out.
Obviously, we can do everything that we can on campus to monitor what's going on, but the university really has no idea what's going on off campus. Definitely Water Street in the bar setting, that's something that would be concerning for me.
In late June, the Eau Claire City County Health Department announced potential COVID-19 exposures at three popular college bars. Nearly 40% of all positive cases in Eau Claire County have come from people in their 20s. Eau Claire chemistry major Joseph Tirado just finished 2 weeks of quarantine after both of his roommates tested positive for COVID-19, though he says they didn't show symptoms. Despite a surge of cases this summer, he wants a return to in-person learning at UW-Eau Claire after his spring semester classes and chemistry labs went virtual.
Once we went online, we were just given the data and we didn't get any laboratory experience, which is really important for me for internships and my future career. And I completely missed out on that, so I was really upset about that, and I really hope I don't do that again this year.
In fact, Tirado says if the campus had announced an online-only fall semester, he wouldn't have enrolled. Though some students may be eager to return to campus, many faculty and other staff are not. A union-sponsored survey of more than 400 UW-Madison employees showed more than 86% of respondents felt uncomfortable or extremely uncomfortable about the idea. UW-Madison Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies, Sammy Schalk, says she opted to teach her classes online.
So for me, my partner is higher risk, and it's just not worth it.
And Schalk says with a summer surge of COVID-19 in Madison that led to a ban on indoor dining and drinking at bars and restaurants, she sees the writing on the wall.
It just seems so clear to me that at some point we are going to have enough of a spike that we are not going to be able to have face-to-face classes, and I would rather just already be planning for online personally.
But not all college employees can work from home. UW-Milwaukee University Services Assistant Stanny Asaitis has remained on campus since its abrupt shutdown in March. He says the administration has been very open about the steps being taken to make the fall semester as safe as possible, but many are still worried.
We're the front door, the front line. We're the ones that are going to be in the hallway with the crowds. Various university staff are going to be the ones that go in between classes to clean the place. Yeah, there's concern.
Dr. Mary Beth Graham is the medical director of infection prevention at Frederick Hospital in Milwaukee. She says their intensive care unit is no longer overflowing with patients suffering from COVID-19, but numbers have remained fairly steady.
It will be interesting to see what happens in the fall because, again, the best laid plans of the institution are only as good as your students following the recommendations and what they're supposed to do. That's a potential weak link.
University administrators have said repeatedly the return to campus this fall is about student education rather than money. But finances are a factor after the UW system reported more than $212 million in losses from the spring shutdown. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, food processing plants were early hotspots for COVID-19 here in the Midwest. We'll find out what went wrong and why some workers are still worried about their safety on the job. The U.S. Census Bureau says it's going to wrap up in-person data collection efforts a month earlier than originally planned. That has some communities worried that they will be undercounted. A reporter from NPR joins the show to tell us what is at stake. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk about new tricks and recipes we've been trying in the kitchen lately, and we want you to join in with your latest cooking experiments. You can get started right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have a conversation set up there. You can tell us what you're cooking. If you're turning back to some old favorites, maybe share a picture or two while you're there. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with a look at golfing opportunities around the state and some advice for beginners on how to get started. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then sold out, out of stock, back ordered. Those might be some words you've encountered lately. We're in this pandemic together, and it seems we're also wanting to buy the same things as each other at the same time. We'll talk to a marketing professor about what we've all been wanting to buy over these past few months and what it says about who we are. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.